That's the plan. Now, Hoekstra was in on that, and this was a big hoax, right? And he's head of the House Intelligence Committee. He's the fellow that I gave back my intelligence commendation award to. That's how bad it is. So without that, now, you know, there's a representative around here somewhere who sits on the Homeland Security Oversight Committee. They just got a report card. The average grade was D minus of what they've been able to achieve. And the congressional overseas are set by, well, all the money goes out to Iraq to build prisons and stuff like that, and our chemical plants especially, and other vulnerable pieces of real estate here are pretty much ignored. So oversight is a joke as long as you have the overseers of the same party, and not responsible people, not people with integrity, people who are party hacks. The Military Commissions Act. I don't know if your representative signed that thing, but if he or she did, you ought to hold that person accountable. That is more properly called the Enabling Act, because it's a dead ringer. It's a carbon copy of the act that Hitler prevailed upon his Congress, the German Parliament, to pass in 1933 after their 9/11. Burning of their parliament building. That's what Hitler used. He intimidated their legislators, and they were so cowardly that they went up and gave Hitler the dictatorial powers that allowed him to do the rest of it. Now, I was born at the end of August in 1939, a week before Hitler drove his tanks into Poland and started World War II. So I've had a special interest in that period. I lived in Germany for 5 years, and I had all kinds of opportunity to ask Germans, young and old, how could it be, how could it possibly be that you, among the most educated, most cultivated people in the Western world, could sit by silently and watch Hitler do all this quite legally, not hold your parliamentarians, your congressmen accountable, and just sort of kind of show unreasoned patience to the ninth degree, you know? And I never got a satisfactory answer to that. But the parallels, my friends, are really, really striking. There's one book that's particularly helpful on this. It's called Defying Hitler by Sebastian Hafner. Anybody read that? It didn't get much play in this country, but it was a big sensation in Germany about 10 years ago. This is really the contemporary notes, sort of an autobiography of sorts, of a young lawyer who spent the 20s and 30s in Germany and kept these notes. His son found them about 20 years ago, translated them. And this is what I'd just like to refer to a little bit of what he says, because it's so relevant. The Reichstag burned down, German parliament, and of course Hitler immediately blamed terrorists. These terrorists were communists, but they were terrorists first and foremost. That was the word used. And because of these terrorists, let me read you what Hafner says. I don't see if one can blame the majority of Germans who in 1933 believed that the Reichstag fire was the work of terrorists, communists. What one can blame them for, and what shows their terrible collective weakness of character, is that that settled the matter. With sheepish submissiveness, the German people accepted that, as a result of the fire, each one of them lost what little personal freedom and dignity was guaranteed to them by their constitution, as though it followed as a necessary consequence. If the communists had burned down the Reichstag, it was perfectly in order that the government would take, quote, decisive measures, end quote. He got into the office the day after the fire, and his colleagues, his other lawyers, were discussing, you know, the government's explanation of what happened and so forth. And he asked them if they saw anything out of the ordinary in the fact that their telephones would thence be tapped, their letters opened, and their desks broke into. And they said, no, we don't see much problem. That's what we're going to have to tolerate. And they said, well, on my way in here, I noticed that all the communist literature had been taken off the newsstands. There were no kiosks where you could buy any communist literature, and the hall was very apparent because they usually occupied about a third of the newsstand. And I resent that, you know. He said, I'd like, you know, I think we should be able to read what we want to read. And you know what his colleague lawyer said? Oh, for how long have you been reading communist literature? What do you find in that? What do you think you need to? We don't need to read. That's very odd that you'd be reading communist literature. It's the same reaction I get going around the country asking people, don't you mind if your telephones are blocked, your conversations listened to, your email? And you know what they say? I'm not talking with Al-Qaeda. That doesn't bother me any. So it's the same sort of syndrome. So I usually ask them, well, does it bother you that Arlen Specter's telephone is tapped? And most of them say, well, who's Arlen Specter? You know, when I tell them that he's head of the Senate Judiciary Committee and has purview over these things, they say, well, why do you say that? Well, you may recall that when it became revealed in December of last year that the president had authorized this illegal program, he bragged about authorizing it 30 times, in direct violation of criminal law, the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. What became known about that, well, Arlen Specter was in high dudgeon. He said, this cannot be. This is extra legal. We're going to pursue this. I'm going to hold hearings. And he held hearings the next month, in January, and he got Alberto Gonzalez in front. He said, now, Attorney General, you may proceed. And Pat Leahy, the ranking Democrat, said, well, Senator Specter, you forgot to swear the witness in. And Specter said, no, we're not going to swear him in. We swore him in 2 weeks ago, and we just decided we don't have to swear him in. And I'm sitting there saying, get up and leave. This is a travesty of justice. Get up and leave. And of course, none of the Democrats heard me, and none of them left. But that was the first sign. Now, to make a long story short, 7 months later, here's Arlen Specter sponsoring a bill that gives President full liberty to do this kind of thing without any court order, and is this great country or what? Makes it retroactive. You know, holds the president harmless for having violated not only the Fourth Amendment, but U.S. criminal law, the FISA law of 1978. Now, why did Arlen Specter change his mind? Well, I emphasize that what I'm going to say now is speculative. Two FBI agents visited Senator Specter. They always come in twos. And they said, Senator, thanks for receiving us. We just want to tell you that we had a wonderful weekend with Mary Crawford in Cleveland. What a wonderful woman she is. You know, it was just really fun getting to know her. And she told us about your relationship. And we know that you go to Cleveland every weekend from your travel records. And we got to thinking, who has to know about Mary Crawford? I mean, after all. But the president has this bill that's going to catch a lot of tourists, and he'd really like you to sponsor it, because that would be the death knell for all these liberals. You know, if you sponsor this with your strong stance against, so could you do this? And then, you know, who has to know about Mary Crawford? Now, I see some of you back there saying, well, McGovern's gone off his rocker, now he's gone too far. But my friends, this is precisely why the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was drafted and passed in 1978. J. Edgar Hoover and others used to do this all the time, not only to senators and representatives, but to presidents, to Martin Luther King, to anybody else that was up for grabs. Okay, that's why they passed the law. And made that law flexible enough to let it be used to catch foreign espionage agents as well. So it's a cockamamie excuse that the law is too restrictive. Matter of fact, you know, let's take them at their word. Let's say that this program that they wanted to introduce, which included monitoring of American citizens, that it was would be too cumbersome under the existing law to do it. Well, then why didn't they change the law? Put yourself back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I have a friend that says you could have put a guillotine on every street corner in this country and nobody would have objected. I mean, look what we got. We got the Patriot Act within a couple of weeks. In that atmosphere, Congress would have given approval to any modification of FISA that was reasonable. And when Alberto Gonzalez was asked at a press conference on December 19th, after this became leaked about this program, he was asked by a correspondent, well, Mr. Attorney General, why did you do this end run around Congress? Why didn't you backdoor the thing? Why didn't you just go and have the law changed? You know what he said? He said, well, actually, we did go to Congress. We checked out with certain congressmen and senators, and they told us that it would be very difficult. Now, they told us it would be impossible to get a law like that approved. The press missed that, folks, but there it is. I've got the transcript. What does it tell you about this program? What does it tell you about the intrusiveness, the all-encompassing nature of this program that's being directed at us as well as other people? Well, so much for the eavesdropping thing and for torture. We can talk more about it if you'd like. You'd like to be depressed further. What's going on now? Well, some of you know about my conversation with Rumsfeld in Atlanta in early May. We had a chance to... Somebody, a correspondent, asked me the other day, would I declare what I thought about whether Rumsfeld should be fired? And I said, well, you know, fair labeling here. I owe Rumsfeld a lot. I'm not sure I can be completely objective, since he made me a folk hero for two news sites. But I overcame that and said, sure, he should be fired. He should be fired yesterday. Anyhow, the reason I refer to that is some of you will remember the fellow with the black hat. I mean, he actually had a black hat and a white shirt, and he came down when I asked about the weapons of mass destruction, saying, you know, you said you knew where they were, and he very sneakily put himself behind me. The CNN camera was behind us, so nobody could see what he's doing, but he put his elbow in my solar plexus and was easing me away from the microphone. And that's when I said, oh, this is America. Do you remember Rumsfeld standing up there?
Yeah.
And he had a split-second judgment. Does he let me get carried out? Not for heckling him, mind you, but for asking him two substantive questions, to both of which he lied, or does he let me stay? And he makes his answer, no. I'll let him stay for a second. Let him stay for a second. And I can see what he's thinking. I'm not only a star philosopher from Princeton with my new adages, but I'm a great debater, and who's this guy? You know, so let me bring him on, you know. Now, the reason I mention that is because now, if that happened now, I am convinced that the guy in the black hat and three others would have carried me right out of there. Why? Because now it's about intimidation, folks. This is all very deliberate. When Cheney says waterboarding is a no-brainer, that's intimidation, folks. That's meant to scare us all. That's meant to, you know, it's a different kind of campaign now. No more Mr. Nice Guy, if there ever was any nice guy. And they're counting on our sheepish submissiveness. There was one German who rose to the occasion. Actually, there were a couple, but one we all know is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who did try to speak out and form a confessing church. This was the most depressing thing of all, of course. Where were the German churches? Why could the Catholic Church, why could the Lutheran Church not find their voices? Well, this was going on, and they're very similar situations. Now, where are our churches? Where are they talking about? You know, why are they silent? Anyhow, there was a fellow named Albrecht Haushofer, and he was a Geolog. He was a geologist at the University of Berlin, and he had tenure. Some of you know what that means, tenure. Okay, so he had pretty well made. And he had tenure because he kept his mouth shut. When Hitler started invading other countries and wrapping up his household for his Jewish friends, he decided that he had a conscience, and that spoke to him and prompted him to speak out. And he spoke out very strongly and acquired quite a following around him. So he was wrapped up by the SS, put in a separate prison from Bonhoeffer, and condemned to be shot. Now, the SS was very methodical, and they insisted that before they shoot you or hang you, you had to sign your confession. Confess and sign a confession. And Haushofer refused to do it, so they got so angry they shot him anyway. As they picked him up off the floor, out of his pocket falls this little zettel, this little piece of paper on which he had written his confession. It's brief. I'd like to recite it for you, and then I'll translate it. Schuld. Any of you know German? Schuld. Okay. Guilt. Right? Doch. Bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher, earlier, I could have earlier. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. I should have earlier recognized my duty. Ich musste schärfer Unheil, Unheil nennen. Unheil is evil, okay? Schärfer is more sharply. So, I should have more sharply called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. I put off my judgment far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug. Genug. Enough. Und klar. Claro, clear, okay? So, I did warn, but not enough and clearly enough. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today I recognize what I was guilty of. There is such a thing as too late, folks. And we're just about that period, I'm convinced. There comes a time when we have to do other things than we've been doing. There's a time when we need to put our bodies into it. There's a time when we have to stand up and not be guilty of unreasonable patience. And I think this is that time. We've got about a week to work to do this in an orderly way. I hope that you all can recognize the folks that voted for this fascist legislation. This legislation makes a mockery of our Bill of Rights and the constitutional protections that we have all enjoyed up till now. And I hope we can be enlightened enough and courageous enough and active enough in this next week to turn those people out and put people in who have a respect for our rights, respect for our Constitution, because there is such a thing as too late. And the poet Dante, you know, famously said, the hottest fires in hell are reserved for those who in times of crisis remain neutral. Now, just to finish up here, you should know that I Googled hell yesterday, okay? And I found out that it was 10 degrees hotter in hell yesterday than it was in Crawford, Texas. And I can testify that it's pretty hot. So let's let that be an admonition to all of us. Let's eschew this unrestrained patience or unreasoned patience. Let's act like patriots and not like sheepish, submissive Germans, because we don't have a lot of time left to make sure we turn this around. Thanks very much.
That was former CIA analyst Ray McGovern speaking on October 10th in Chatham, New York. Thanks to the Chatham Peace Initiative and Hummingbird Films for that recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
Here that build the big guns, here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs, here that hide behind walls, here that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe. But I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, fear to bring children into the world, for threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know, I'm younger than you. That even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon.
In the talk we just heard from former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, he mentioned living in Germany and asking many people how the German nation could have succumbed to the Nazis. McGovern said he never got a satisfactory answer to his question, a question that I think is central to anyone who desires a truly free society. How is it that a small group of people can intimidate, deceive, or stupefy a huge number of people into submitting to a social arrangement that actually prevents most of them from ever reaching their full stature as human beings? Ironically, advertisements for the military promise people that in the military one can be all you can be, when in reality, the military deliberately transforms people into obedient, callous killers at the beck and call of individuals at the top of the hierarchy. The subtext of the military message is that one becomes something only as a cog in a powerful machine. This is the essence of militarism and nationalism, epitomized by the Nazi Reich, but equally applicable to ditto heads. Both involve relinquishing autonomous thought to someone who will tell you what to think and feel, and slaving oneself in the most basic way. A person whose body is in bondage, but whose mind is free, can one day devise an escape. But a person whose mind is in bondage, who cannot even dream of freedom, will never be other than a slave. And that is why the shaping of our minds is of such interest to me, and a primary component of the material presented to you on this program. Last week, in our ongoing reading of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, we began Chapter 7, The Prussian Connection, wherein Gatto explained how the structure and purposes of American compulsory schooling were modeled after the schools of Prussia, which was the seminal modern totalitarian state. A state in which the citizen cedes all rights in return for basic security, a state where, at the time of the American Revolution, Prussian women were required to report monthly to the police on the onset of menses. If Germans would submit to such a state in the 18th and 19th century, it is not so surprising that they would submit to a similar state in the 20th. But Gatto is talking about the Prussians because 19th century American elites strove to emulate Prussian society by recreating their school system here. Last week's reading contained a description of the three levels of schooling in Prussia. The top level were private schools for the elites, the only schools that gave a real education fit for human beings, teaching people to think, to plan, to argue, to understand history, to envision society's course. The next level, the top state schools, were to train professionals, technocrats, and the police, the ones that would realize the social visions of the elite group. The largest group of Prussian youth attended what were called the people's schools, where they were filled with propagandized history and conditioned to obedience. Gatto wrote, quote, "Prussian schools delivered everything they promised. Every important matter could now be confidently worked out in advance by leading families and institutional heads, because well-schooled masses would concur with a minimum of opposition." Close quote. What is emerging as one reads Gatto's book is, I think, an important understanding about the people who pushed through the American education system. Obviously, there had to be a consensus, at least on some level. And the proponents of this system believed themselves to be acting in the best interest of society. These educational reformers were quite upfront about their desire to manage and mold the working class. Underlying their zeal was an ugly and elitist premise that is very much alive and well today, that the people slated to a life of drudgery are fit for no better. After all, if you are a person with a conscience, how do you doom another person to standing on an assembly line from morning to evening, making repetitive motions, robbed of creative satisfaction and control of even the minutes and hours of one's life? Sitting when you want to sit, standing when you want to stand. But in order for a few people to get very rich and live lives very different from this, large numbers of people must be persuaded to submit mentally as well as physically to such a life. How does one justify this if one is a moral person in a nation that gives lip service to liberty and equality? By claiming that this is all that some people are fit for and that they are happy doing that. I've heard people say this, and it's garbage. And you can know it's garbage very simply. If you weren't paid to do the job you're doing, if you didn't need to earn money, exactly how many more seconds would you remain at your job? Or how would you do what you are doing differently if you could decide? And why can't you decide? Gatto spent 30 years as a teacher in the New York City public schools and as a result turned against the educational system. What he realized is that the purpose of the system was not to make dumb people smart, but the reverse, to manufacture broken, dulled people who could be slotted into the economic and social hierarchy. It is true that we all have unique talents and abilities, personalities, strengths, and weaknesses. But there is not a single human being so bereft of capacity, creativity, or intelligence that the best that they can be is to spend their lives saying, "Would you like to try the value meal? Fries with that?" So how does a small group of people steal the lives of a large group, enslave them to their purposes, and make them accept this condition as normal, natural, even good? First, by destroying their pride and self-confidence, making them believe they can do no better, have no choice, by making them fear life, the world, each other, and then promising protection. Last week's readings contained an explanation of how the Prussian school program was developed, including that it was modeled on animal training. Quote, The area of individual volition for commoners was severely foreclosed by Prussian psychological training procedures, drawn from the experience of animal husbandry and equestrian training, and also taken from past military experience. Close quote. So let us resume our examination of Prussia and its schools, which, as Gatto said, had these goals: to deliver obedient soldiers to the army, obedient workers for mines, factories, and farms, well-subordinated civil servants trained in their function, well-subordinated clerks for industry, citizens who thought alike on most issues, national uniformity in thought, word, and deed. Continuing with the conclusion of Chapter 7 of The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Information about Prussian schooling was brought to America by a series of travelers' reports published in the early 19th century. First was the report of John Griscom, whose book, A Year in Europe, written in 1819, highly praised the new Prussian schools. Griscom was read and admired by Thomas Jefferson and leading Americans whose intellectual patronage drew admirers into the net. Pestalozzi, who was a Swiss academic mentioned in last week's reading, came into the center of focus about the same time as the letters of William Woodbridge to the American Journal of Education, letters which examined this strange man and his, quote, humane methods through friendly eyes. Another important chapter in this school build-up came from Henry Dwight, whose Travels in North Germany, written in 1825, praised the new quasi-religious teacher seminaries in Prussia, where prospective teachers were screened for correct attitudes toward the state. The most influential report, however, was French philosopher Victor Cousin's to the French government in 1831. This account by Cousin, France's Minister of Education, explained the administrative organization of Prussian education in depth, dwelling at length on the system of people schools and its far-reaching implications for the economy and social order. Cousin's essay applauded Prussia for discovering ways to contain the danger of a frightening new social phenomenon, the industrial proletariat. So convincing was his presentation that within 2 years of its publication, French national schooling was drastically reorganized to meet Prussian Volksschulen standards. French children could be stupefied as easily as German ones. Across the Atlantic, a similar revolution took place in the brand new state of Michigan. Mimicking Prussian organization, the heavily Germanic Michigan established the very first state superintendency of education, with a state minister and state control entering all aspects of schooling. The only missing ingredient was compulsion legislation. On Cousin's heels came yet another influential report praising Prussian discipline and Prussian results, this time by the bearer of a prominent American name, the famous Calvin Stowe, whose wife Harriet Beecher Stowe, conscience of the abolition movement, was the author of its sacred text, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Stowe's report to the Ohio legislature attesting to Prussian superiority was widely distributed across the country, the Ohio group mailing out 10,000 copies, and the legislatures of Massachusetts, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Virginia each reprinting and distributing the document. The third major testimonial to Prussian schooling came in the form of Horace Mann's seventh report to the Boston School Committee in 1843. Mann's sixth report, as noted earlier, had been a paean to phrenology, the science of reading head bumps, which Mann argued was the only proper basis for curriculum design. The seventh report ranked Prussia first of all nations in schooling, England last. Pestalozzi's psychologically grounded form of pedagogy was specifically singled out for praise in each of the three influential reports I've recited, as was the resolutely non-intellectual subject matter of Prussian Volksschulen. Also praised were mild Pestalozzian discipline, grouping by age, multiple layers of supervision, and selective training for teachers. Wrote Mann, quote, "There are many things there which we should do well to imitate," close quote. Mann's report strongly recommended radical changes in reading instruction from the traditional alphabet system, which had made America literate, to Prussia's hieroglyphic-style technique. In a surprising way, this brought Mann's report to the general public attention, because a group of Boston schoolmasters attacked his conclusions about the efficacy of the new reading method, and a lively newspaper debate followed. Throughout 19th-century Prussia, its new form of education seemed to make that warlike nation prosper materially and militarily. While German science, philosophy, and military success seduced the whole world, thousands of prominent young Americans made the pilgrimage to Germany to study in its network of research universities, places where teaching and learning were always subordinate to investigations done on behalf of business and the state. Returning home with a coveted German PhD, those so degreed became university presidents and department heads, took over private industrial research bureaus, government offices, and the administrative professions. The men they subsequently hired for responsibility were those who found it morally agreeable to offer obeisance to the Prussian outlook. In this leveraged fashion, the gradual takeover of American mental life managed itself. For a century here, Germany seemed at the center of everything civilized. Nothing was so esoteric or commonplace that it couldn't benefit from the application of German scientific procedure. Hegel of Berlin University even proposed historicism, that history was a scientific subject, displaying a progressive linear movement toward some mysterious end. Elsewhere, Herbart and Fechner were applying mathematical principles to learning. Müller and Helmholtz were grafting psychology to behavior in anticipation of the psychologized classroom. Fritsche and Hitzig were applying electrical stimulation to the brain to determine the relationship of brain functions to behavior. And Germany itself was approaching its epiphany of unification under Bismarck. When the spirit of Prussian Peloton Feuer crushed France in the Lightning War of 1871, the world's attention focused intently on this hypnotic utopian place. What could be seen to happen there was an impressive demonstration that endless production flowed from a Baconian liaison between government, the academic mind, and industry. Credit for Prussian success was widely attributed to its form of schooling. What lay far from casual view was the religious vision of a completely systematic universe which animated this Frankensteinian nation. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The little North German state of Prussia had been described as an army with a country, a perpetual armed camp, a gigantic penal institution. Even the built environment in Prussia was closely regimented. Streets were made to run straight. Town buildings and traffic were state-approved and regulated. Attempts were made to cleanse society of irregular elements like beggars, vagrants, and gypsies. All this intended to turn Prussian society into a huge human automaton, in the words of Hans Rosenberg. It was a state where scientific farming alternated with military drilling and with state-ordered meaningless tasks intended for no purpose but to subject the entire community to the experience of collective discipline, like fire drills in a modern junior high school, or enforced silence during the interval between class periods. Prussia had become a comprehensive administrative utopia. It was Sparta reborn. Administrative utopias spring out of the psychological emptiness which happens where firmly established communities are non-existent, and what social cohesion there is weak and undependable. Utopias lurch into being when there is no other social and political life which seems attractive or even safe. The dream of state power refashioning countryside and people is powerful. especially compelling in times of insecurity where local leadership is inadequate to creating a satisfying social order, as must have seemed the case in the waning decades of the 19th century. In particular, the growing intellectual classes began to resent their bondage to wealthy patrons, their lack of any truly meaningful function, their seeming overeducation for what responsibilities were available, their feelings of superfluousness. The larger national production grew on wheels and belts of steam power. The more it produced unprecedented surpluses, the greater became the number of intellectuals condemned to a parasitic role, and the more certain it became that some utopian experiment must come along to make work for these idle hands. In such a climate, it could not have seemed out of line to the new army of homeless men, whose work was only endless thinking, to reorganize the entire world and to believe such a thing not impossible to attain. It was only a short step before associations of intellectuals began to consider it their duty to reorganize the world. It was then the clamor for universal force schooling became strong. Such a need coincided with a corresponding need on the part of business to train the population as consumers rather than as independent producers. In the last third of the 19th century, a loud call for popular education arose from the princes of industry, from the comfortable clergy, professional humanists, and academic scientists, who saw schooling as an instrument to achieve state and corporate purposes. Prior to 1870, the only countries where everyone was literate were Prussia, its tiny adjacent neighbor states in Nordic Scandinavia, and the United States. Despite all projects of the Enlightenment, of Napoleon, of the parliaments of England and Belgium, and of revolutionaries like Cavour, the vast majority of Europeans could neither read nor write. It was not, of course, because they were stupid, but because the circumstances of their lives and cultures made literacy a luxury, sometimes even impossible. Steam and coal provided the necessary funds for establishing and maintaining great national systems of elementary schooling. Another influence was the progressivism of the liberal impulse, never more evident than in the presence of truly unprecedented abundance. Yes, it was true that to create that abundance, it became necessary to uproot millions from their traditional habitats and habits. But one's conscience could be salved by saying that popular schooling would offer, in time, compensations for the proletariat. In any case, no one doubted François Guizot's epigram, "The opening of every schoolhouse closes a jail." For the enlightened classes, popular education after Prussia became a sacred cause, one meriting crusading zeal. In 1868, Hungary announced compulsion schooling. In 1869, Austria. In 1872, the famous Prussian system was nationalized to all the Germanies. In 1874, Switzerland, followed by Holland and Belgium. Between 1878 and 1882, it became France's turn. School was made compulsory for British children in 1880. No serious voice except Tolstoy's questioned what was happening, and that Russian nobleman, novelist, mystic was easily ignored. Best known to the modern reader for War and Peace, Tolstoy is equally penetrating in The Kingdom of God is Within You, in which he viewed such problems through the lens of Christianity. The school movement was strongest in Western and Northern Europe, the ancient lands of the Protestant Reformation, much weaker in Catholic Central and Southern Europe, virtually non-existent at first in the Orthodox East. Enthusiasm for schooling is closely correlated with the nation's intensity in mechanical industry, and that closely correlated with its natural heritage of coal. One result passed over too quickly in historical accounts of school beginnings is the provision for a quasi-military, non-commissioned officer corps of teachers and a staff-grade corps of administrators to oversee the mobilized children. One consequence, unexpected by middle classes, though perhaps not so unexpected to intellectual elites, was a striking increase in gullibility among well-schooled masses. Jacques Ellul is the most compelling analyst of this awful phenomenon in his canonical essay, Propaganda. He fingers schooling as an unparalleled propaganda instrument. If a schoolbook prints it and a teacher affirms it, who is so bold as to demur? And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Administrative utopias are a peculiar kind of dreaming by those in power, driven by an urge to arrange the lives of others, organizing them for production, combat, or detention. The operating principles of administrative utopia are hierarchy, discipline, regimentation, strict order, rational planning, a geometrical environment, a production line, a cell block, and a form of welfareism. Government schools and some private schools pass such parameters with flying colors. In one sense, administrative utopias are laboratories for exploring the technology of subjection, and as such, belong to a precise subdivision of pornographic art, total surveillance and total control of the helpless. The aim and mode of administrative utopia is to bestow order and assistance on an unwilling population, to provide its clothing and food, to schedule it. In a masterpiece of cosmic misjudgment, the phrenologist George Combe wrote Horace Mann on November 14, 1843, quote, "The Prussian and Saxon governments, by means of their schools and their just laws and rational public administration, are doing a good deal to bring their people into a rational and moral condition. It's pretty obvious to thinking men that a few more years of this cultivation will lead to the development of free institutions in Germany." Close quote. Earlier that year, on May 21, 1843, Mann had written to Combe, "I want to find out what are the results as well as the workings of the famous Prussian system." Just 3 years earlier, with the election of Marcus Morton as governor of Massachusetts, a serious challenge had been presented to Mann and his Board of Education, and the air of Prussianism surrounding it and its manufacturer-politician friends. A House committee was directed to look into the new Board of Education and its plan to undertake a teacher's college with $10,000 put up by industrialist Edmund Dwight. 4 days after its assignment, the majority reported out a bill to kill the board. "Discontinue the normal school experiment," it said, "and give Dwight his money back." Quote, "If then the board has any actual power, it is a dangerous power, touching directly upon the rights and duties of the legislature. If it has no power, why continue its existence at an annual expense to this commonwealth?" Close quote. But the House committee did more. It warned explicitly that this board, dominated by a Unitarian majority of 7-5, although Unitarians comprised less than 1% of the state, really wanted to install a Prussian system of education in Massachusetts, to put a monopoly of power in a few hands, contrary in every respect to the true spirit of our democratical institutions. Close quote. The vote of the House on this was the single greatest victory of Mann's political career, one for which he and his wealthy friends called in every favor they were owed. The result was 245 votes to continue, 182 votes to discontinue. And so the House voted to overturn the recommendations of its own committee. A 32-vote swing might have given us a much different 20th century than the one we saw. Although Mann's own letters and diaries are replete with attacks on Orthodox religionists as enemies of government schooling, an examination of the positive vote reveals that from the outset, the Orthodox churches were among Mann's staunchest allies. Mann had general support from the Congregational, Presbyterian, and Baptist clergymen. At this early stage, they were completely unaware of the doom secular schooling would spell out for their denominations. They had been seduced into believing school was a necessary insurance policy to deal with incoming waves of Catholic immigration from Ireland and Germany. The cheap labor army, which as early as 1830 had been talked about in business circles and eagerly anticipated as the answer to America's production problems. The reason Germany, and not England, provided the original model for America's essay into compulsion schooling may be that Mann, while in Britain, had a shocking experience in English class snobbery which left him reeling. Boston Common, he wrote, with its rows of mottled sycamore trees, gravel walks, and frog ponds, was downright embarrassing compared with any number of stately English private grounds furnished with stag and deer, fine arboretums of botanical specimens from faraway lands, marble floors better than the tabletops at home, portraits, tapestries, and giant gold-framed mirrors. The ballroom in the Bulfinch House in Boston would be a butler's pantry in England, he wrote. When Mann visited Stafford House of the Duke of Cumberland, he went into culture shock. Convicts on treadmills provide the energy to pump water for fountains. I have seen equipages, palaces, and the regalia of royalty side by side with beggary, squalidness, and degradation, in which the very features of humanity were almost lost in those of the brute. For this great distinction between the stratified orders of society, Mann held the Anglican Church to blame. Give me America with all its rawness and want. We have aristocracy enough at home, and here I trace its foundations. Shocked from his English experience, Mann virtually willed that Prussian schools would provide him with answers, says his biographer Jonathan Messerly. Mann arrived in Prussia when its schools were closed for vacation. He toured empty classrooms, spoke with authorities, interviewed vacationing schoolmasters, and read piles of dusty official reports. Yet from this non-experience, he claimed to come away with a strong sense of the professional competence of Prussian teachers. All are, quote, admirably qualified and full of animation. His wife Mary, of the famous Peabody's, wrote home, "We have not seen a teacher with a book in his hand in all Prussia. No, not one." This wasn't surprising, for they hardly saw teachers at all. Equally impressive, he wrote, was the wonderful obedience of children. These German kinder had innate respect for superior years. The German teacher corps, quote, the finest collection of men I have ever seen, full of intelligence, dignity, benevolence, kindness, and bearing. Never, says Mann, did he witness an instance of harshness and severity. All is kind, encouraging, animating, sympathizing. On the basis of imagining this miraculous vision of exactly the Prussia he wanted to see, Mann made a special plea for changes in the teaching of reading. He criticized the standard American practice of beginning with the alphabet and moving to syllables, urging his readers to consider the superior merit of teaching entire words from the beginning. "I am satisfied," he said, "our greatest error in teaching lies in beginning with the alphabet." The heart of Mann's most famous report to the Boston School Committee, the legendary Seventh, rings a familiar theme in American affairs. It seems even then we were falling behind, this time behind the Prussians in education. In order to catch up, it was mandatory to create a professional corps of teachers and a systemic curriculum, just as the Prussians had. Mann fervently implored the board to accept his prescription while there was still time. A note of hysteria is a drum roll sounding throughout Mann's entire career. Together with vilification of his opponents, it constitutes much of Mann's spiritual signature. That fall, the Association of Masters of the Boston Public Schools published its 150-page rebuttal of Mann's report. It attacked the normal school's proposal as a vehicle for propaganda for Mann's hotbed theories, in which the projectors have disregarded experience and observation. It belittled his advocacy of phrenology and charged man with attempting to excite the prejudices of the ignorant. Its second attack was against the teacher-centered non-book presentations of Prussian classrooms, insisting the psychological result of these was to break student potential for forming the habit of independent and individual effort. The third attack was against the word method in teaching reading and in defense of the traditional alphabet method. Lastly, it attacked man's belief that interest was a better motivator to learning than discipline. Duty should come first and pleasure grow out of the discharge of it. Thus was framed a profound conflict between the old world of the Puritans and the new psychological strategy of the Germans. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. 60 years later, amid a well-coordinated attempt on the part of industrialists and financiers to transfer power over money and interest rates from elected representatives of the American people to a Federal Reserve of centralized private banking interests, George Reynolds, president of the American Bankers Association, rose before an audience on September 13, 1909, to declare himself flatly in favor of a central bank modeled after the German Reichsbank. As he spoke, the schools of the United States were being forcibly rebuilt on Prussian lines. On September 14, 1909, in Boston, the President of the United States, William Howard Taft, instructed the country that it should take up seriously the problem of establishing a central bank on the German model. As the Wall Street Journal put it, an important step in the education of Americans would soon be taken to translate the realm of theory into practical politics, in pedagogy as well as finance. Dramatic symbolic evidence of what was working deep in the bowels of the school institution surfaced in 1935. At the University of Chicago's Experimental High School, the head of the Social Science Department, Howard C. Hill, published an inspirational textbook, The Life and Work of the Citizen. It is decorated throughout with the fasces, symbol of the fascist movement, an emblem binding government and corporation together as one entity. Mussolini had landed in America. The fasces are strange hybridized images, one might almost say Americanized. The bundle of sticks wrapped around a two-headed axe, the classic Italian fascist image, has been decisively altered. Now the sticks are wrapped around a sword. They appear on the spine of this high school text, on the decorative page introducing part one, again on a similar page for part two, and are repeated on part three and part four as well. There are also fierce military eagles hovering over those pages. The strangest decoration of all faces the title page, a weird interlock of hands and wrists which, with only a few slight alterations of its structural members, would be a living swastika. The legend announces it as representing united strength of law, order, science, and the trades. Where the strength of America had been traditionally located in our First Amendment guarantee of argument, now the Prussian connection was shifting the locus of attention in school to cooperation, with both working and professional classes sandwiched between the watchful eye of law and order. Prussia had entrenched itself deep into the bowels of American institutional schooling. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 7, The Prussian Connection, from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. John Taylor Gatto was an award-winning teacher who served for 30 years in the New York City public schools. He resigned publicly in 1991 after having been named New York State Teacher of the Year as a result of his long-dawning realization that schools were quote, dumbing down children. This book is the result of 10 years of research following his departure from the school system. He's become one of the nation's foremost advocates for homeschooling and self-directed education. He has a website, johntaylorgatto.com, G-A-T-T-O.com, where you can download this book in its entirety, as well as read about his other projects. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. The rich will come down.